Welcome to Inside West Point, Ideas That Impact. I'm Brigadier General Shane Reeves, the Dean of the United States Military Academy at West Point. Through a series of discussions, we will show you a different side of West Point, where we will make even our most complex initiatives accessible to broad audiences and give you an inside view to our cross-disciplinary work, which is being applied throughout the world.
Welcome back. Today, we have a real treat as we welcome Dr. John Malinowski for today's episode. John is a professor of geography in our Department of Geography and Environmental Engineering. Welcome, John.
Thank you, sir.
So let me tell you a few highlights from John's bio. John is a professor of geography in the Department of Geography and Environmental Engineering. Raised in Vermont, he earned an undergraduate degree from the School of Foreign Service at Georgetown and a master's and doctorate in geography from UNC Chapel Hill. He joined the faculty at USMA in 1995, which makes him one of our longest-standing civilian professors. He's the co-author of several books and textbooks and was recently co-chair of the team that led the Academy's 2021 reaccreditation efforts. I'm absolutely thrilled to talk to him today, especially about his newest book with the West Point Press, The West Point Landscape, 1802 to 1860. I think what might be most interesting, John, is your incredible ability to dig up original photos, videos, or facts in under 30 minutes of time at any point of the day. I know you've been a tremendous resource for my team and I, so what's the secret? How do you find all this stuff? I mean, literally like in 15 minutes, you can have a picture of Central Area or North Area from whenever.
I wish I had I could say that I was so well organized that I knew where everything was, but it's more of just by looking at West Point history for so many years, I sort of know what exists and possibly where to find it.
Yeah.
And then that kind of sends me down a hallway. And then I can either check an online archive or look in my own collection or reach out to somebody for that. But it's sort of a sense of roughly where it is, not always exactly where it is. And that's kind of a good insight into my organizational technique.
Okay. So get ready, because this whole thing has given me a number of ideas. This is going to be a really fun conversation. We might need to pull all our history buffs into the archives and have a fact-finding race. Like, if you were going to do that, how would you prepare for that? If I was going to pull you in and be like, okay, you're in there, you're competing with a number of other people to dig through the archives on a particular, I'm asking you to find a particular picture, what would be the first thing you'd do?
Well, the serious answer is get to know the finding aids, which tell you what's there. The less serious answer is practice reading really bad quill pen 19th century writing that has been photographed four decades ago.
Yeah.
And poorly reproduced on microfilm.
I would, if you were going to ask me that, I'd be like, I would do like a 20-minute series of stretching and take ibuprofen.
There you go.
That's how I approach any competitive activity. Okay, so before we get into these specific questions, I thought we could lay some groundwork. So here's a simple question for you. Give me an overview, if you can, of West Point geography from our nation's foundings until today in just a couple of minutes.
Yeah, I think there's maybe three ways of thinking about this when I think about the geography of West Point. One is actually just West Point as a place and the size of the place. I mean, West Point today has all of this land all the way over to Monroe. But when the Academy opened, the entire, like the range only went from about where the DPW building is to Grant Hall. And even where Mahan Hall is was off the reservation. The Academy didn't own Fort Putnam. That wasn't on government land. So the place itself was really small and then slowly grows. You know, Buffalo Soldier Field is really late 1800s before that land becomes part of the Academy. So that's one way. Like what we think of as West Point was once much smaller. The second way is to think about like the character of the place at the time. So we think of West Point now as having collegiate Gothic architecture. But of course, if you were here at certain times, there was none of that architecture. This, you know, the place, the spirit of the place would have seemed different just because the buildings were different.
Oh, interesting.
There's also the fact that for 100 years or so, there would have been so many horses here, right? Just, you know, cadets had to learn how to ride. There were horses everywhere. Now that's, you rarely see a horse at West Point. So there's those kind of aspects of what the place was like. In the 1870s, a large percentage of the soldiers here were immigrants. They would have had Irish accents and Scottish accents, you know, and we don't experience that quite in the same way today. So the character of West Point has changed as well. And then the third way of thinking about West Point is in its relationship to the Hudson Valley. You know, the Hudson River is kind of sleepy these days. We see a few boats a day. But at one point, it was hundreds of sloops and steamboats going up and down the river. You know, when the Academy opened, at that time, the average amount of time to get to Albany from New York City was 7 days by sailboat. And then we get steamboats, in the 1810s and into the 1820s, and it goes down to a day and then down to 8 hours. So by the late 1820s, there's just massive amounts of steamboats. The Erie Canal opens up and the Hudson becomes this massive highway. So we don't really think of that today, but the Hudson was this amazing internal highway, and every important person who went on vacation, came up the river. They stopped here. They went to the resorts in the Catskills. They went to Saratoga Springs. Later, they went to Niagara Falls. Foreign guests would stop here. We had a hotel literally on Trophy Point. So the West Point, we often think of like historic West Point as being isolated, but it was really only isolated in the winter, and the rest of the year, it was just this thriving place on this major highway. And that made it a place that America got to know because America stopped here, at least a certain class of Americans stopped here.
So it's interesting how times have changed, because now it only takes 2 days to get from Albany to New York City on Labor Day. Hey, yeah, so you said something. You said that when cadets arrived in the fall of 1801, Thomas Jefferson, of course, signs the executive order on March 16th, 1802. So were cadets here prior to the signing the executive order?
Yeah, a handful of cadets. I think it's about a dozen or so arrived in the fall of 1801 and started, like Swift, who was the first graduate, arrived in September or October of 1801. And there was one instructor and they did some classes and then it sort of stopped. But they were starting. I mean, earlier in 1801, they said, we're going to do this thing. And they had cadets report. And then it becomes official in the spring of 1802. But 1801 is really when the first cadets arrived.
That's fascinating. All right. So I hear that it's almost a sport for historians to correct each other. With your expertise on West Point's history, have you ever discovered any common inaccuracies?
Yeah, there are some common ones. The one that gets me the most is there's a 1780 map of West Point. At least it's labeled 1780, but it's actually from about 1815, and it's completely wrong. And it shows up on publicly displayed informational graphics. Sure. It shows up on book covers. It shows up on social media. And I have a hard time being polite about it, but just it's just wrong.
I know what your cover of your book's going to look right now.
It will not have that map. There are myths that I hear pretty regularly, like the notion that the superintendent's basement was originally the first floor because the plane had been raised. And there was some flattening out of the plane, but the first floor of the soup's house was always the first floor, and the basement was always. So you hear those kind of things. Or the dates of the soup's house, that the soup's house is the oldest house when it's actually the commandant's house, is a year earlier. And that's pretty clear from the record. But a couple sources, you have the dates wrong, and then everyone just picks up on that. There's language. For example, a lot of historians will talk about the 19th century, and they'll use terms like in his cow year, when the term cow doesn't really appear until like the 1920s.
Sure.
Yeah. Or firsty. Nobody would have used the term firsty that I can find until the late 1930s. So you get those kind of terms as well, yearling and plebe, but you can easily find history books that say, and then we'll talk about Grant's cow year.
Yeah.
And they wouldn't have, right? So there's those kind of inaccuracies too.
And are you, like, when you come across those, do you put forth the effort to fix the record?
Sometimes, but if it's a published book by a major press or something like that, it's hard to do that.
I will tell you, the campaign to have the Commandant's House recognized as the oldest being built in 1819, that's taken hold.
It has taken hold, and I mean, the issue with a factoid like that is that some historians get it right and others have gotten it wrong, but when people are doing research, they don't always check multiple sources, right? So you have to find it.
Yeah.
And then I think the final one is the notion that West Point's always been Gothic, gray, collegiate Gothic. And we see that in Pale Blue Eye, which I like as a movie. But here you have Edgar Allan Poe wandering around Gothic buildings. There was not a Gothic building at West Point for another 10 years after Poe left.
Define for me what Gothic style is.
The most defining element of Gothic that we see is the pointed arch.
Okay.
Right. And we obviously have lots of them, but there are other things, rib vaults, which is sort of a vault made out of like a ceiling made out of pointed arches. There are other aspects like dripstones over windows. At West Point, we also have crenellation where the top of the building looks like a castle. You know, we have some elements like that, but those features did not come in until the late 1830s or early 1840s. So Edgar Allan Poe would have seen gray stone buildings, but they were basically federal style. You know, they looked more like the shape of the White House or something
Kind of like
that.
The superintendent or the commandant's
exactly,
house. Or the
yes.
dean's house is more Victorian, I'd say.
Gothic revival is traditionally the way that...
Is that what you would call the dean's house?
Gothic definitely
revival.
Gothic
What's
revival.
That mean?
So in the 1830s and 1840s, there were a number of books that were published that popularized a certain type of residential house as being Gothic revival, meaning harkening back really to the medieval times. And some of those proponents were in the Hudson Valley and in New York. So we're really at sort of like the hotbed. But basically, it's this style of architecture where you have the gingerbread along the roofline, and there's other elements. You'll notice, for example, on your front porch has a pointed arch very subtly in the porch.
Yeah.
Steeply pitched roofs are another element of Gothic homes. And at least three Gothic revival, it's really more than that, but at least three Gothic revival homes just in that area, your house or the Dean's quarters, also the Marty Marr house where he never lived. And there was another building next to that was torn down for Ike Hall.
Okay. So let me change a bit here. Why are geographers focused on landscape and landscape change?
Landscape is a concept in geography that goes back serious discussion for about a century, really back into the 1920s. And it's one of those terms that you could do a whole podcast series on what landscape means to different types of geographers. Huh. For a physical geographer, it would mean something different. But as a human geographer, cultural geographer, I like to think of landscape as really how humans have modified the natural landscape. And we do that through culture. We do that through intentional choices. Right? So it's really the modified physical landscape, which becomes something of its own. So in the sense of West Point, you could think, for example, why do we end up having Gothic buildings? Those were choices. Why do the officers live on the high ground of the plain and enlisted barracks were over the hill, or the utility buildings were down over the hill in the past? All of those decisions over time were made for certain reasons that end up changing the landscape. And geographers believe that if you look closely at the landscape, you can see those cultural legacies kind of preserved in the landscape.
So it actually makes me think about, on my social media, we have a theme on Mondays called Inspiration Monday. And the goal is to really highlight some of the incredible things that take place at West Point. And some of that can be programs, some of it can be activities, some of it can be the landscape, the buildings, and some of it can be about the cadets themselves. And so we've really started to have cadets take over on the Inspiration Mondays. And it's really inspiring for me just to hear about all the places at West Point that have meaning for them. And then connecting that with your work. So first off, I'd say thank you for connecting with them and helping them understand the history of West Point and dispel some of the myths and also connect them to the history of West Point. But what do you think gives someone meaning when it comes with landscape? Like, how do you connect meaning with landscape for an individual?
Psychologists have this term affordances. In other words, that particular things afford certain benefits to somebody or certain opportunities. So when you look at the landscape, if somebody is going to form an attachment to a landscape, it means that something in that landscape is giving them something of meaning. So it might be a place to hang out with their friends, or it might be a place to be quiet, or it might be that a particular building is connected with a really good or really bad time. And that's what a lot of the geography literature focuses on, how those place attachments get formed. And if you think about it, it's different for every person and every group. A tourist who visits West Point one time who's viewing it from the stands has a different view than a plebe in their third week, right, who's in central area getting drilled. Or the difference between what West Point means, how somebody reacts when they're leaving on graduation day versus when they come back 5 years later. Right. So, and it's going to be different for every group because the landscape is just one factor that gives something different to every person that's experiencing it.
You have a great definition that I think we need to flesh out. You have a definition for what a place is. What is a place in your mind?
So a classic way of thinking about a place for geographers is space plus meaning, right? Because we have infinite number of spaces on the Earth's surface, right? Depending on how you divide it up. But many of those spaces that we're in as we go through life don't have any meaning to us. But a handful of them you develop either positive or negative feelings towards. And I think that's a good way of thinking about place, right? If you think back through your life, there might have been a favorite tree that you like to climb as a kid, or a certain place you'd like to hang out, or in college, a certain place where you'd like to hang out or study. And I think that's the same thing for people that spend time at West Point, is that you develop this, that certain places or certain time periods, you get that meaning attached to the place. And again, that can be either a love of place, which the geographer Yifu Tuan called topophilia, or it could be a fear of place as well, a topophobia, a thing like that, right? Yeah. So, you know, the way we interact with places is full of those meanings. Or every year I hear people say, I'm so happy to be graduating. I'm not sure I ever want to come back. And then 6 months later, you know, they're back and, oh, I miss this place,
yeah,
right?
Exactly.
I mean, because of that meaning that they attach to the place.
Now, did you use, is the term topophobia?
Topophobia is one of,
all right.
Yeah.
So, can you have topophobia and love of the same place? Because I lived in Bradley Barracks for 4 years. I had topophobia and then love, but it evolved over time.
Sure.
Yeah. You can have both?
Of course.
It's not binary?
I don't think it's binary.
Great, because I have it.
So what inspires you about West Point?
There's a couple things that inspire me. One is always cadets, because as a geographer, I'm lucky to teach at a school that is teaching focused, and we have students that come from every corner of the United States. I mean, it's just, to be able to have a cadet in class whose parents run a chicken farm in North Carolina versus somebody who's from Singapore is just, you know, boundless opportunity for an instructor.
Yeah.
So that's the always the most inspiring thing. And even with my social media work on West Point history, getting a cadet question is always, you know, the most fun, all right, because it means that they're developing an interest in something that I care about. I think personally, for me, in the West Point landscape, what does inspire me is the Gothic Arch, because the Gothic Arch goes all the way back to Mesopotamia or ancient India. It's part of Persian architecture and then Islamic architecture, and it ends up in Europe 800, 900 years ago, where they modify and use it to build these incredible cathedrals that give us, in the modern day, the architecture that we have around. So when I see a Gothic Arch, I mean, it's completely nerdy, but I'm always excited by seeing a Gothic arch at West Point, because it harkens back to something that goes so far back in time and gives us that particular character.
Do you think you've seen all the Gothic arches at West Point?
No, there's no way. Yeah. They're hidden all over the place.
Yeah. So when you stumble across one, are you like, well, there's one, I haven't seen that.
Look at that. It's a segmented arch, or it's a, yes.
When you talk about a Gothic arch inspires you, can you explain what it looks like?
So a Gothic arch is basically a pointed arch.
Yeah.
Right? So historically, you could build a building by putting up pillars and putting a flat board across the pillars. And then eventually, in ancient times, people started using semicircles, so basically a round arch. And we do have those at West Point too. If you look at the old cadet chapel, we often call that a Roman arch, but a rounded arch. But the problem historically with a rounded arch is the height of a building is really limited by the diameter of the circle. But with a Gothic arch, which comes to a point that you can actually build, the width of a building can be varied, because you can just make the arch more or less pointed and you can build as high as you want. So basically, when you see a pointed arch, that is often in our landscape a Gothic arch. Historically, there could be some Islamic arches that are also pointed, but at West Point, pointed arch, Gothic arch.
You've made tremendous contributions to your field and to society's understanding of West Point throughout history. So thank you for doing that. And so as I just lay out a few things, you've had five books, five book chapters, a monograph, digital exhibits, countless peer-reviewed articles, not to mention your very active contributions on and off social media. You run a really popular, exciting, fascinating, and enjoyable called Execution Hollow, which I think everybody really appreciates. Let's talk about your most recent book. So what does it focus on?
So a few years ago, I did an ebook on the first 30 years of West Point buildings.
Did you start in 1802 or 1801?
I started in 1802, only because if I put 1801, I knew that people would think that I had made a mistake. But there is a beautiful painting of West Point from 1801 that's in the new book and in the old book. So, and it does touch on the Revolution. But the West Point Press, which is new and expanding, asked me if I would be interested in publishing that earlier ebook. And I really didn't want to do it. I didn't want to take something that was sort of done and just slap a new, you know, a new cover on it. So I said, why don't we take it up to the Civil War? So the book covers pretty much every major building and some other landscape changes at West Point until 1860. And I picked 1860. One is you have to stop somewhere because it has to be manageable amount of work. But also we get so many scholars and so many people are interested in our the contributions of West Point to the Civil War. And I figured it'd be a great resource for scholars to understand what was here at the time that various Civil War generals were walking the ground. So,
and I would ask you what inspired you to do it, though I think it's probably self-evident, your love for the West Point's architecture and the history of that architecture. But what do you hope the readers take from it?
I hope the readers get a different view of what early West Point is like. Because again, we think of West Point as gray, Gothic, large buildings. And it during that time, it was only Gothic for half of that time. So to understand the cadets that were here during the Thayer era, what West Point looked like, what it was like, what the layout of the place was, you can't get that as easily from the existing sources. So
I was trying, as you're talking, I was trying to think of some buildings that might be representative that still exists. Would the fronts of Professor's Row be in that era?
Yes, absolutely. So the superintendent's quarters, the commandant's quarters, and the three Professor's Row duplexes are all late 18-teens or 1820s. And you can see, for example, the commandant's quarters and the superintendent's quarters have a similar architectural style. They're often considered to be federal, which goes up in the U.S. from about the Revolution up until about 1820. And really, the Professor Row buildings are probably considered the same. But what I love about the Professor's Row buildings is that stone, the gray stone with the pinkish sandstone trim, is really the color of early West Point.
Right.
That's what the buildings would have looked like. We still see it on the Firstie Club, the old ordnance compound, and in Nininger. That's local stone with Connecticut sandstone is what where we think it comes from. That what gives you a good sense of what West Point would have been like in the time period.
So when you're saying local stone, you said the Connecticut sandstone, is where did the gray stones come from?
Most of the gray stone for the early buildings, and really actually some of the later buildings, they sometimes are importing and sometimes quarrying locally. But certainly the Professor's Row, we believe, came from local stone. In fact, right behind the Dean's quarters, there was a large ridge of rock, 15, 20 feet high, it seems to be, that ran pretty much from Professor's Row all the way to where Arvin Gym is today. And you can still see a little bit, there's a little bit left of it near the guard shack behind Arvin, but there was a large amount of rock there that they quarried, and then a few other places on post. So that is generally local stone. It's nice, not granite.
That's really fascinating. Yeah.
We say carved in granite, but most of our older buildings are actually nice. Although in the 19th century, gneiss, which is a different kind of rock than granite, it's granite that has gone through. It's a metamorphic rock. It's been heated, and it's granite that's been put under pressure and heat for a long period of time. But 19th century, they would have called it granite, but it's not actually granite.
So tell me about any unusual collaborations you've had in your research.
Yeah, recently I was lucky to work with Dr. Mike Butkus in my own department. He's an environmental engineer, and he was interested in the water history and the water infrastructure of West Point since the earliest days. And I was able to help him with some of the historical aspects. So that's a fascinating. We got a good publication out of that. You know, West Point, it's a great lesson in government planning too, because they always would tell the government, yes, we need this new water system because we need this much amount of water. And then 5 years later, they were running short on water, you know. but you also see how societal change kind of throws curves at you. For example, in 1892, they completed the first dedicated gymnasium designed by Richard Morris Hunt, a famous architect, and it had a pool. So suddenly they needed 88,000 gallons of water out of Delafield Pond, and then later out of Lusk.
Yeah.
And there was no chlorine in those days, so they had to refresh the water. every 3 or 4 or 5 days because it would just get disgusting.
Yeah.
So, you know, they hadn't predicted 10 years earlier that they were going to need an extra 90,000 gallons of water every week. So there's all this kind of constant pressure, or the government expands the number, the size of the core, or we get toilets, right? So when toilets start coming into houses and indoor plumbing, all of a sudden all the water use changes.
And you think, yeah, that thing about air conditioning now, right?
Exactly.
Or like the requirements on the energy grid by increased research in certain energy.
So it's this constant drive to find water over the, up until World War II.
Interesting. Okay, so where do you see your work going into the future?
There's always more work to be done on buildings. You know, there are, the information on what we built is a little bit scattered among archives across the country. So there are still kind of factual information about what we built and photos and drawings out there. So I definitely want to continue that. And then I've also developed this interest in things that West Point was going to build and never built. So I recently did a project on the, there was supposed to be a memorial arch between Bartlett Hall and Pershing Barracks, which were the two academic buildings for a long time. And they never built it because of budget cuts and various issues like that. But there's a whole, there's dozens and dozens of designs for West Point that were never built. So I'd like to explore that and think about what West Point would have been like. You know, for example, Richard Delafield chooses Gothic in the late 1830s as the style for West Point. But that same year, the Academy was still getting designs that would have made West Point a Greek revival, you know, columns and steeples and pediments and things like that. If we had gone that route, we might have never had a Gothic building, and we would look more like the Naval Academy or a building that's, you know, a campus that's a little bit more neoclassical.
What's the most interesting plans you've come across that did not get built?
There are beautiful designs for barracks and other buildings from that late 1830s period with beautiful Corinthian columns on the front that I think would have just been stunning. One of the weirdest that I've found is that there was a plan for a school when they built Stony Lonesome up on the hill in the 60s. They were going to build this giant round school, elementary school or middle school, that looked like a spaceship. I mean, literally round, flying saucer-shaped, very modern building.
Like Apple's headquarters now?
Exactly.
Yeah.
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 Round, multi-story, glass windows, this giant.
Where was that going to be?
I think it was probably on the top of Stony, where there, I think there's a playground now up there on the hill, meaning like there would be a school in the middle of the residence. It's a little unclear from the plans, but they were going down that road of space age, you know, space race America in the 60s.
Wow. Okay. So, you know, this year's academic year theme is innovation, technology, and the future of national defense. So how do you see innovation through the years as it relates to historical geography?
Right. It's odd to think of innovation as history, but I think the lesson is that in whatever discipline that you're in as an academic or just as somebody who's naturally curious, is that there's always work to be done. If you think of human knowledge as a brick wall, there's a lot of bricks that still have to be filled in.
Sure.
So I don't think that we should think of innovation simply as nanotechnology and robots and cyber, because we're never going to produce 1,000 cyber warriors every year. That's not what the Army needs. So I think for me, innovation is looking at the past through a new lens, right? What stories haven't been told? There's large West Point history stories about soldiers that haven't been told, or the band, or the servants that were here. And there's all those stories that haven't been completely told. And I think that is innovative because it expands those disciplines. But then I also think that there are new technologies. I recently was able to pair with colleagues in my department using LIDAR, which is basically laser scanning, to scan buildings to try to get an idea of where the memorial bridge that I mentioned earlier, right, where it would have actually attached to the building. So there are these technologies, drones and things like that, allow us to visualize the landscape in the past. And I think as an undergraduate institution, those kind of forays, being able to use a modern technology to look at the local landscape, gives cadets and faculty a way of learning those technologies that they might, again, then apply to somewhere else in the future.
Yeah, that's interesting. The application of technology to try to solve some of these historic mysteries does two things. Like you said, it connects to the past, but it also allows those who are using the technology to get hands-on experience in doing it. So what I'm gathering is there are these really rich connections to the story of broader American society all across the West Point landscape. And I oftentimes say that. I oftentimes will tell people that I think the history of West Point is the history of the United States. So really, how unique is it? How unique is it to have these rich connections between the American story and a not just a college, but like a military post?
Well, I mean, from my perspective, I mean, West Point is certainly has a unique history because of the focus of the academy as a producer of officers for the Army. But in a lot of ways, we are also similar to other colleges. For example, in my own work on architecture, Yale and Harvard were building Gothic buildings right at the same time we started building Gothic buildings. And what you find is that West Point was very much tied into national trends. We were building Greek Revival when the country was building Greek Revival, because Greek Revival meant democracy, right? And then we're building Gothic because Gothic was tied into the Romantic movement of the early 20th century, and it was considered to be this hearkening back to a great period of medieval Christendom and issues like that. Or when you look at Cullum Hall and it's back in Greek, it's basically a Greco-Roman language. That's at the time that the American Renaissance was back in architecture, and we're building that. And then we go back to Gothic at a time when Gothic is also being commonly produced on colleges. So it's a hard question to answer because West Point always has this unique history, but I think we're a little bit more trendy
than we think.
There's this often repeated notion that Richard Delafield chose Gothic architecture because it was military. And that gets parroted by some historians. And eventually, West Point did use that justification. Well, we need Gothic because it looks like military. But when you look at what Delafield said to Totten in letters in the late 1830s, when he's saying, like, no, we're going to go with this design and not a Greco-Roman Greek Revival design, what he says is that it's better suiting to the scenery. Well, that's classic 19th century romanticism. And he's saying it's collegiate, right? NYU had a Gothic building that was finished 2 or 3 years before us. It was from a town in Davis, very famous architects. There's no way that the West Point engineers would not have known about this beautiful Gothic building that was being built. When they build a mess hall, it would become to be known as Grant Hall in the 1850s, it's Romanesque Revival, and it copies elements right off the Smithsonian, which was the hot scientific institution of the time, and was in fact, the building was finished by a West Point grad after they had trouble finishing it in the early 1850s. The guy who finished Grant Hall here, it was just known as the Mess Hall then, goes and then finishes the Smithsonian. So here we are tied in to this great educational and scientific organization. They didn't make that decision just because they thought it looked most military. That was always a factor because we're a military institution. But they were tying our landscape into other things that were going on. And I think that's important for us to remember.
Including, as you pointed out, other institutions of higher education and what they were doing.
Yep.
And as you said, the what looks nice, the aesthetics of it.
Right. Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah, that's an interesting point. Okay, let me switch up a bit.
Okay.
How long have you been at West Point?
It's my 29th year, almost 30 years.
So you're making a run for being one of the longest tenured faculty at West Point. You don't have it, but you're making a run at it. I can only imagine some of the stories that you have over those 29, almost 30 years. What's kept you at West Point so long?
I think there's a number of factors. As I mentioned before, being able to teach cadets is really a joy. I think if you're going to go into academics, you want good students, and we have great students and interesting students who jump out of airplanes on the weekend and, and go to debate tournaments and all those kind of things. And other schools have that too, of course, but we know that our cadets are special in many ways. Junior faculty, this ever cycling junior faculty come in. Every year you get a new group of people that are telling you what the discipline is talking about. Out in active graduate programs, they're bringing in new technologies. They tend to be up to date on the new technologies. So I find that. And then quite honestly, after I developed an interest in
West Point, what better place to be if you're studying West Point history than at West Point? So, you know, you get to a certain point where I'm just sort of dedicated to trying to, you know, finish a career here.
So, and thanks for being willing to do that, because I know talent has options and you're clearly a talented guy. So it's great for you to be at West Point. And you talked a little bit about the junior rotating military, and you have a really important role in mentoring the junior rotators. One of the things I love about the junior rotators is the amount of energy they bring.
Right.
And their recency, not just in coming right from grad school, but also in terms of the Army. And they and the cadets have, they connect with the cadets both in terms of, I mean, honestly, their age is a little bit closer to the cadets. They've got a lot of energy in the classroom, and they can talk to the cadets about what they've seen in the Army. Can you just reflect a little bit more on what you have thought of the junior faculty and how you connect with them?
I think you touched on something important, which is that they are closer to most civilian and senior faculty to their the operational Army in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
So I think when a 28-year-old captain stands up in front of a class of cadets and tells them that they should pay attention because they're going to see it in the Army, that means more than coming from
me, right? From Shane Reese's. But they're like, that guy's wrapping it up. He's almost done. Look at that guy.
From a civilian in his 29th year.
Yeah, right. Right.
I mean, that's, and they do bring that energy. They're always coming in with ideas. And sometimes the nice thing about balancing that with faculty that's been here a long time is sometimes you're able to say, no, we tried that.
Yep.
And it didn't work. But other times you're like, wow, that's a really good idea. And you're able to run with that. So I love having that new crop of leaders come in every year.
And the power of having our civilian faculty, and you fit in that role as one of the senior civilian faculty here, is being able to mentor those junior faculty and helping them evolve into being educators versus training. I say this oftentimes that there's a big distinction between education and training. We do both here at the Academy very well, but training is this, you know, you do something repetitively where you really are trying to fire a weapon. Education is preparing a student for uncertainty, which means that there might not be right answers and you have to be willing to push them in different directions. Do you see lights come on in a junior faculty's eyes when they start to realize the difference between education or training, or do you think most have it when they walk in the door?
No, I don't think most have it when they walk in the door. I mean, that's why we have good new instructor training. And I mean, they certainly have a lot of the skills, and some of them probably come in the door better instructors than me and a lot of other people that are here just because of their natural personality, because we get such special, you know, faculty that are coming in. But I do think there is somewhere in that first or second semester that they're teaching a realization of what they need to do to make that connection. Or you'll see a clump of new faculty discussing how to approach a different issue. You know, how should we talk about the wind over the mountain problem in dirt or something like that? And I mean, they're learning from those experiences from each other too, and how to approach a particular issue.
So you have a whole range of knowledge about West Point in terms of teaching and education and the history of the place. I'm actually really blown away by it. How much time would you say you spend in the library archives?
At times, I've been in there many hours a week.
They reserve a seat for you? Do you have like your own John Malinowski like special seat, like a plaque on the back?
I have a favorite seat, but no reserve seat.
Okay,
because
yeah,
you never know. There could be a class in there or something. And Susan Lintelman, one of our great archivists, does joke that I'm the scholar in residence sometimes. But no plaque on the chair.
So I hear you have an extensive personal archive.
I do.
So what inspired you to develop a personal archive?
For me, it was the search for the story not told, right? So our history books generally cover the same events. The annual cycle of what West Point covers is the same. You're going to get ring weekend, and then you're going to get Army football, and you're going to get Army Navy, and you're going to get winter break. But to be able to collect magazine articles that were not official, to be able to collect cadet scrapbooks, I think that's immensely valuable, to be able to see the backside of buildings, right? To see things that, to be able to see the handwritten notes that people made. And some of that you can find in archives, but when I see it in an antique store or I come across it, you know, I like to grab it up. And hopefully a lot of that will get donated to the Academy.
One of my favorite possessions is my grandfather graduated in 1939. I have his scrapbook, and there's pictures of him and my grandmother, for example, Delafield Pond.
I'd love to see it.
I'll have to show that to you. All right, so this has been an absolute blast. Thanks for doing this, truly.
My pleasure.
Thank you for doing it.
My pleasure.
I like to end episodes with rapid-fire questions.
I'm scared.
No, it's fun. So just humor me here. The key is brevity, though. Like, we got to go fast.
Okay.
All right, here we go. And you only get a few seconds. If you think about it too long, it's not rapid-fire. Okay. Favorite building on West Point? Go.
Pershing Barracks.
What's your favorite building anywhere?
It's probably a place called Conlon Hall at a summer camp in New Hampshire, where I spent a lot of time growing up, and I was a camper, a leader, and then a member of the board. Just deep personal.
That's good. Yeah. If you could have dinner with any historical person, who would it be?
Ibn Battuta, who was a medieval Muslim explorer who traveled over 70,000 miles, because I think it would be an invaluable way of learning about things that we don't have much written history of.
That is a good answer. That'd be awesome. Favorite quirky project?
I mean, I think making 3D models of buildings that we never built is pretty quirky.
That's pretty quirky, but cool. I know that you are a cornerstone of the Dirt Band. So what is your favorite song?
Favorite song? Summertime Blues, the Who Live at Leeds version.
Nice. Most prized possession?
Probably a copy of old West Point regulations that also has the barracks police regulations. In other words, sort of how cadets were supposed to keep the barracks rooms.
When's that from?
I think the copy I have is from the 20s. It was called the Blue Book, and cadets had to keep it in their rooms.
Okay, you have 30 seconds to give a sales pitch to a future officer to major in geography. Go.
Geography is just a great discipline for a cadet who wants to be prepared for a career that might not be clear right now. You never know what the Army is going to do. If you graduated here in the class of 1988, you thought you were going to East Germany. And 2 or 3 years later, the Soviet Union had fallen apart and everybody was in Iraq and in the Middle East. And I think geography is a discipline that prepares you well for that because you get broad knowledge of the environment and cultures of the world. And I just think it's a great major for an Army officer.
I would double down and say that it has a great reputation amongst cadets. Cadets really enjoy the major and the department and the faculty. It has a great climate. So thanks, John. Thanks for taking some time today.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure.
Yeah, it's been a lot of fun. Please be sure to tune in to the Inside West Point Ideas That Impact podcast next month. Remember, you can find this podcast as well as the other podcast journals and books hosted or published by the West Point Press at westpointpress.com. Until next time.